Hello, this is Newsdesk from Guardian Unlimited, and it's Thursday, March the 23rd. I'm John Dennis. Today we're rounding up reaction to yesterday's budget speech from Gordon Brown. With me is Oliver King, editor of Guardian Unlimited Politics, and from our personal finance site, Guardian Unlimited Money, Susan Smiley. Could either of you lend me a fiver?
Well, only if, John, if you're going to spend it on a low-carbon emission car, as Gordon was trying to promote yesterday.
And you know it's not going to get you a packet of cigarettes anymore.
Curses. Well, today we'll also hear why thousands of protesters in Thailand are demanding the resignation of the Prime Minister. We'll consider whether the ceasefire by the Basque separatist group ETA will hold, and also whether Germany's World Cup hopes have been revived. But first, here's Mark Oliver with the papers.
The papers, of course, are dominated by the budget today, Gordon Brown's 10th budget yesterday, and it goes down pretty well overall in the papers, with broadly positive write-ups, although, as you might expect, there's slightly more waspish treatment in the Daily Mail and the Telegraph. Of course, this is really, for a lot of the papers, round one in the new looming fight between Gordon Brown and Tory leader David Cameron. Some of the commentators are increasingly suggesting that Tony Blair is becoming more and more irrelevant. One of these, Jonathan Friedland in the Guardian, says that Brown's main rival is no longer the man sitting next to him.
What's the Sun said?
The Sun, it's gone for gloves come off in fight for number 10. The Mail says that Iron Chancellor tightens his grip. And the Telegraph says Brown rattles the door to number 10, noting his decision to cut taxes but to find more money for education, and his plan to narrow the gap between private and state schools.
Now, what about this bomb trial, which is also having some coverage in the papers today?
Yeah, it's day two on the bomb trial at the Old Bailey, where seven British Muslims are accused of plotting a bombing campaign. And the main line in the papers today is allegations by the prosecution that one of the accused, Salhan Amin, 31, tried to become a kind of a middleman between a cell in Pakistan, a terror cell, and the Russian mafia trying to get some material to create a so-called dirty bomb.
And what's the Mail spin saying about this Muslim girl?
Well, Shabina Begum, 17, is the Luton student who last year won an important landmark case regarding her Islamic dress. Back last March, the appeal court said that she could wear Islamic dress, and it was breaking her human rights to stop her from doing it. But yesterday, the law lords overturned this, and the Mail is unequivocal on its editorial line on the story. It says, defeated, the schoolgirl who wasted £100,000 of our money so that she could wear full Muslim dress.
And quite a lot of the papers have got pictures of this extraordinary sleeping position for a builder.
That's right, this is an amazing picture. More than 500 foot up in the air, we've got a builder with his fluorescent jacket and everything on, reclining on a huge steel girder, apparently fast asleep.
And on the back pages, there's a game you were actually at last night, Mark.
That's right, Chelsea versus Newcastle. Chelsea dumped Newcastle out of the cup, winning 1-0. And I, like the rest of the Newcastle fans, were chanting at the Chelsea fans, saying that they were cheats. This is something that Newcastle captain Alan Shearer has said as well. He attacked Sean Wright Phillips for diving right at the end of the game.
That was Mark Oliver, and you can read Mark's review of the papers at guardian.co.uk/wrap. Now, more on the budget. Let's give you the facts first about Gordon Brown's 10th budget. Our economics editor is Larry Elliott.
The first thing I have to say about it was that he was very upbeat about the economy. The economy had a bit of a tough time in 2005. He was quite confident that the economy was going to pick up steam in 2006, 2007 and 2008, and that would give him the foundations to make some long-term changes which he thought were necessary for improving Britain's chances of meeting competition from overseas. So there were a whole range of very small measures in areas such as science, skills, employment policy, designed to actually make Britain a more productive and more efficient place to do business.
And were there any surprises?
There were a couple of surprises left really right until the end. Up until that point, it had all been pretty much as trailed. The end of the speech, there was some there was an attempt to pre-announce some of the measures that would be in next year's spending review, and it's quite obvious that spending review is going to be quite tight because the government is not as well off as it was 4 or 5 years ago, and the government is obviously going to channel all its resources into education. So there was a big package of education reform towards the end. Schools are going to get more money given directly to head teachers. There is going to be an attempt to raise the amount spent per pupil in the state sector to the level in the private sector by 2011. There were some measures for further education so that people who fall through the net when they're at school have the opportunity to carry on and carry on doing their A-levels up until their age of 25 free. So there was quite a lot of education measures, which was £400 or £500 million pounds worth of extra spending. There was also extra money for defence and security and for the Home Office for policing.
Now, that was Gordon Brown's first face-to-face clash with the Commons with the new opposition leader, David Cameron. Perhaps a sign of things to come when, as expected, Mr Brown takes over from Tony Blair. Oliver King from our politics site. How did Cameron get on yesterday?
Well, he didn't do too badly. It's one of the worst jobs for an opposition leader to have to respond to a budget that you haven't seen. So, I mean, there were some pre-prepared gags, but they went down pretty well. They cheered up the Tory backbenchers. I mean, there was a slight shrill quality to it because, I mean, he was being barracked all the time by the Labour side. I mean, the Speaker had to intervene at one point to help David Cameron out. But he had some good gags, and he pointed to the fact that Gordon Brown has been there a long time, and he said he was stuck in the past.
And could this be Gordon Brown's last budget speech?
Well, that's interesting. I mean, everybody down at Westminster was trailing it as Gordon's tenth but last budget. I mean, the feeling is now shifting slightly towards the fact that Gordon might have to make another one. But he certainly warmed the hearts of Labour MPs by announcing all this money for education, and certainly contrasted with Tony Blair last week having to, you know, arm wrestle people through the division lobbies for education reform that most Labour MPs are not particularly happy with.
So Susan Smiley from our personal finance site, what sneaky tricks did Gordon Brown have up his sleeve that are going to affect us ordinary people?
Well, actually, some of this year's budget was pretty welcome. There was more help for families with a rise in child tax credit by 14%, childcare vouchers going up £5 to £55. A lot of it was restating things that we already know, such as more money for child trust funds at age 7, ISA limits will stay the same, and more help for home buyers, which is welcome. A lot of people are saying, though, that the meagre rise in stamp duty by £5,000 just isn't going to be enough to help first-time buyers.
I mean, Ollie, do you think there wasn't really much substance to the budget, and in a sense he was just sort of setting out his stall as a prime minister in the waiting?
Well, it was trailed as a consolidation budget. I mean, a lot of the announcements on spending he's going to make next year, but I mean, he did. I think because of the problems that the party had been having with sleaze, and also the problems that the party had been having with the internal divisions on education, I think that's why he pre-announced next year's comprehensive spending review to warm the hearts of Labour MPs.
Okay, now Ollie, very briefly, if you can, today on Guardian.co.uk politics, you can hear the first of our new weekly politics podcast. Can you tell us what's in today's show?
Well, a little bit of history. We've got Michael White and Julian Glover talking to the Labour MP Kitty Usher. We have a little bit of Alexei Sale, and David Henke, the Guardian's own investigative ferret, has been delving into the Labour Party's finances and tells us all about that.
Oliver King and Susan Smiley, thanks. And if you're still eager for more on the Chancellor's speech, have a look at guardian.co.uk/budget. The Basque separatist group ETA has announced the first ever complete ceasefire, and it's received a cautious welcome from the Spanish government, although the Spanish papers today are calling on ETA to back up its truce by ending low-level violence such as extortion from Basque businesses and threats against local, non-nationalist politicians. Giles Tremlett's in Madrid. We asked him whether this declaration should be taken seriously.
And the Spanish government has reacted with caution. This certainly isn't the first time ETA has had a ceasefire. Is this one any different?
Well, yes, it looks different. I mean, it would be impossible to say until we see the full result of it. On this occasion, however, ETA has given lots of signals in advance that it is ready to talk. The Spanish government has given signals that it is ready to talk. And ETA also is at a point where it is far weaker than it was when it last declared a ceasefire in 1998. That ceasefire was a surprise to almost everybody. This one was expected quite a long time ago.
And what will happen now? Will the group decommission its weapons and join the political process? This is an announcement made by masked men, after all.
Well, we have no idea what will happen next. It says its ceasefire is permanent, but it also talks about some vague conditions of there being a democratic process in the Basque country with some kind of vote amongst the Basques about what should happen next, with that vote having to be recognized by both the Spanish and the French governments, because ETA also claims part of France as part of what it would like to be a separate Basque country. So I think all this does really is open the door to a peace process, which one assumes will be as fraught and difficult as peace processes elsewhere.
Giles Tremlett. Now, today's quick quiz question. What's the name of the British hostage who has just been released in Iraq? You can find out after this.
Guardian Unlimited.
And the answer is Norman Kemba. Last night, Germany's football team beat the United States 4-1 in a friendly match. Before the match, German fears of an early exit from the World Cup in June had been mounting. Luke Harding's the Guardian's Berlin correspondent. Luke, has last night's result calmed the nerves of the host nation?
I think it did. Germany really has been in a state of terrible collective gloom for the past 3 weeks, ever since the disastrous defeat by Italy, where Germany lost 4-1. In an away friendly. And now, last night, Germany managed to win, beating the USA 4-1. And there's kind of enormous relief here, I think, that because the big fear was that Germany might fall flat on its face in the World Cup this summer and possibly even exit in the group stage, which for a host nation would be a terrible embarrassment. But the papers here this morning are full of celebration. Bild, which is sort of Germany's answer to the Sun, has got the front page headline, Klinzy, jetzt darfst du grinzy, which means Klinzy, now you can grin again. Because they nicknamed him Grinzy Klinzy after he grinned after their kind of horrible defeat. So
pressure's off a bit for Klinzy.
The pressure's off, but if you think that Sven has had a bad time in Britain from the press, it actually, it hasn't been half as vicious as what poor old Jürgen has had to put out with in recent weeks.
And tell us the latest about ticketing.
Yes, well, less than 80 days to go to the World Cup. Most England fans haven't got tickets. More than 100,000 England fans are expected to go across to Germany. But the good news, it seems, is that I've been given a very strong hint by the Interior Ministry that if you can get a ticket for the game, even if it's not your ticket, then you're going to be let in. There's been kind of big ambiguity here as to whether people who get tickets on the black market but don't have the right passport number to sort of support the ticket will actually be allowed into stadiums. It now seems that they will be, unless you're caught in the spot check. So my advice to any England fans out there who don't have tickets is to basically steal them, borrow them, beg them, I don't know, get them. If you get them, you'll probably get in. That's my advice.
Luke Harding in Berlin. In Thailand, thousands of people have been demonstrating, demanding the resignation of the Prime Minister, Thaksin Shinawatra, who's tried to defuse the protest by calling a snap election in April. John Agliombi's in Bangkok. John, why are people demonstrating?
Over the last few months, the Prime Minister, Thaksin Shinawatra, has managed to alienate not just the middle class, but academics, intellectuals, business people, students and a variety of other predominantly urban groups who feel that he is not only ignoring them, but is basically ignoring all the fundamental tenets of democracy apart from one person, one vote in an election. They point to the fact that he has basically emasculated the judiciary, clamped down on freedom of the press, curtailed various other allegedly, supposedly independent institutions such as the Counter-Corruption Commission, and effectively bought the Senate, people allege, and it's hard to disagree with this. The final straw was at the end of January when he sold his shares, or technically they were his children's shares, in the family business to the Singaporean government's main holding company, Temasek Holdings, for $1.9 billion, and didn't pay a single penny of tax. And what is coming out now is that people involved in the deal are starting to blow the whistle and explain how he manipulated the system for his own good in order to enrich himself and to enrich others.
And can you describe some of the protests that have been taking place?
The protests began in October when a former fan and buddy of Thaksin was suddenly cut from his TV show, and he took his TV show essentially to one of Bangkok's main parks and built up an audience of about 30, 40,000 people. And then after the Shin Corp share sale in January, it suddenly ballooned even bigger. And we're getting tens of thousands of people every week on the streets, and thousands of those are spending camping out on the streets around the Prime Minister's office. It's almost a carnival-like atmosphere. It's quite bizarre. You've got people camping, you've got music, you've got a very slick media machine and operations with stage and sound crews and you name it. You've got Red Cross there, you've got people selling food, you've got people offering haircuts, you've got people offering traditional massages. And every night after work, thousands more people come down and join in, listen to the speeches about the latest allegations concerning the Prime Minister, and there's a lot of razzmatazz, and it goes on till about midnight, 1 a.m. A lot of it's now broadcast live on TV, and then the whole cycle begins again.
It sounds like jolly good fun, actually, but how's the government responded?
The government has responded by trucking and busing and training in tens of thousands of its own supporters from the provinces, and this is one of the big ironies of the whole dispute, is that it's not really a clash between good and evil, because the Prime Minister Thaksin has actually done an awful lot of good for many poor people in the rural areas where he is still exceptionally popular, and he has brought in schemes like 50p healthcare. People can go to the doctor and only pay 50p and get medication and see a doctor. He's also given loans to villages, every village. He's given eased debt burdens on farmers and helped them. So he's one of the first prime ministers who's actually done a lot of good for the rural people. And so it's a rural-urban clash, and he's brought in a lot of his supporters, and they've got their camp in a different part of Bangkok. And they're both trying to stay non-violent and succeeding so far. The military said it doesn't want to intervene. And so far it's sort of descended to a bit of a stalemate ahead of the election on April the 2nd.
And have you got any idea of what will happen on the election?
Well, the three main opposition parties have all decided to boycott the polls. So effectively, Thaksin's Thairak Thai Party, which stands for Thais Love Thais, is the only party standing. Now, this might sound like heaven to any politician, but the problem is, there are two problems. One, in about 270 of the 500 seats, the Thairak Thai candidate is the only candidate. There are a few other minor independents running in the rest. And if they do not get 20% of the votes, then they do not win their vote in that constituency. It's a parliamentary system. Sort of descended to a bit of a stalemate ahead of the election on April the 2nd.
That was John Aglianby in Bangkok. Well, if you have any comments or suggestions about today's show, you can add your voice to the news desk from Guardian Unlimited on our blog at guardian.co.uk/podcasts. I'm John Dennis. Thanks for listening.